ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us all over the Sunshine State this week, right here on the Studcast. And without any further ado, the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. And Ron, I teased it right there, of course, with Sunshine State. We are in Florida, returning from Australia, and this is really when your career starts to pick up and take off.
Yeah, it surely does. I mean, I was looking back at the record of my matches, and I start to see, man, it's pretty amazing what happens in 1973 for me. And, before we go too far here, Brian, I just really want to thank all the fans out there. I mean, the last six episodes of the Studcast, the Atlanta Wrestling War Trilogy and the Australian Trilogy have just been bombs. I mean, they have just lit things up, fabulous audience. And I just want to thank fans for all their comments and things like that. You know, before we get started in getting back to America, you know, I just want fans to know I really appreciate all the comments and all the reactions to both those programs, both of those three sets of programs, actually. And we're going to be doing some more, actually, on the Atlanta Wrestling War. Later on, we'll talk about that. But that we're not finished with that, as a matter of fact.
No, we're not finished with that. We're going to return once again to the Atlanta Wrestling War on the next Rest of the Story for patrons of the show. More about that later on. And of course, we will return to Atlanta as we continue with the story in chronological order. And the story continues into 1974. But here we are, Ron, 1973. One of the wrestlers that you would end up getting to work with in 1973 was Dick Slater. So before we get going to this story, picking up in March of 73, it may be time to say a little bit about Dick Slater. You said you would last week at the end of the program, and of course, he did just pass away. What are your thoughts right now about Dick Slater?
Well, and I mean, Dick was one of the best wrestling friends I had. For 48 years, I knew Dick Slater. I met him in 1970. He was working out at that time and starting to train in the sportatorium. And the old snake pit, but, it wasn't snake pit training. He was actually trying to learn to wrestle. And he was great friends with Mike Graham. In fact, they went to the same high school in Tampa. And then Dick goes on to become a football player at the University of Tampa. And a darn good one at that. He had a really long and successful career, and just a fantastic talent in the ring. He's a legendary kind of babyface or heel. Didn't make any difference. He just was a really great worker, and he was well liked as well. I mean, guys loved him all over the country. Everywhere he went, people liked him. He got along very well with guys. I became a fan later on of Dick's once he got started in wrestling itself and got himself into the ring. And I could probably do a whole show easily on Dick and our times together, but I've got a few stories I'd just like to start off with that I just want to focus on his instinctive ring psychology, and that's such a lost art in the sport today. Dick seemed to have it. He just, you can't train that, You can't go into the gym and take backdrops and take bumps and learn how to sell and learn how to do the things you need to do. That psychology is just something that it's instinctive to some wrestlers, and he had a great deal of it. And he was a tough guy. I mean, Dick was a dangerous guy. He was very, very rugged, and he also had a wild side, like a lot of wrestlers do. And I'd like to start off with his ring psychology. And I remember watching Dick in his very first match in West Palm Beach in the early 70s, probably in the time frame that we're talking about, maybe in a year prior to this 1973, 72 or so, he started wrestling. And his first match ever was in West Palm Beach. My dad happened to be there that night, and he was on the first match. So, you know, when you want to look at these young guys and see how they do in their first match. So Dad and I stood out there back of the building. People couldn't see us. The fans couldn't see us. And we watched Dick just to see how he was going to do. And when they rang the bell, he started down the aisle. And he walked, maybe it's a long walk in that big auditorium there in West Palm. And he had somebody scream at him. You know, he was a heel coming out of the heel side, but they'd never seen him before. So somebody screams at him and he stops and he milks it. He looks around like, where'd that come from? And then he's very slow and methodical, takes his time. He takes three or four more steps and somebody yells from the other side and he stops again. And he takes probably 3 minutes to get to the ring. By the time he gets to the ring, he's got half the crowd booing him. They already don't like him. And he crawls up on the apron, climbs up on the steps, gets up onto the apron, and he looks around at the fans like, you know, and they're just booing. He's not really done anything, and he's already got them. And then he grabs the top rope, and he goes to jump over the top rope, and he does it so beautifully. He hangs his toe on the rope as he gets up in the air, and he crashes face first into the mat. And it's a big pop. I mean, the building went crazy, like, wow, oh, they were laughing at him. Then he got up, now he's mad, he's kicking the ropes. He's, you know, he just had that psychology that you could tell this guy's going to be good. In fact, I think my dad, I remember him saying to me after he took the bump, he looked at me and he says, that boy is going to be good. And, you know, he really did turn out to be good. His toughness, we'll talk just a second about Dick's toughness. Dick played on a football team in the University of Tampa with Paul Orndorff and John Matuszak. So John Matuszak in 1973 was the number one NFL draft. He was the number one player drafted in 1973. Now, this is back in the late 60s, early 70s, and they're in college together. Matuszak's made a big name for himself, obviously. Paul Orndorff is a tremendous back. He's a running back, and he's just a phenomenal player. And Slater is right in there with him talent-wise. Well, Slater and Matuszak get into their drinking, and as college kids will do, and they got a little too much liquor in them, and they start to have – Matuszak gives Slater some kind of problem, and Slater knocks him out. Just cold, bang, you know, like Slater should have been a boxer because he had the best right hand I ever saw. And I saw him knock a few guys out. So I saw him knock out Matuszak. I saw him in Orlando wrestling in a match with, he was very green, and so was Bob Orton Jr. And Bob Orton Jr.'s father was there, Sr. Bob Orton Sr. was on the card. And they had a match about the second match, and I went out and watched the match because I wanted to see how they did. And there was a little problem in the ring. You could tell there was a little stiffness going on there. And they got back to the dressing room, and Orton Jr. said something to Slater. And they kind of got face-to-face. Everybody gets quiet. You know, something's going to happen here. And I think Orton maybe took a swing at him, and Dick hits him with that big right hand, bow. I mean, he went down face first. And then he did, I'd never seen this done before. He grabbed him by the hair. Now he's out cold, and he drags him into the bathroom, and he takes his head and puts it in the toilet, and he flushes the toilet. Yeah, I called it after I saw it. I called it the big swirl. You know how the water swirled around his face and down the toilet it went. And so Dick comes back into the you could see into the big the toilet area and back there where the showers were, and everybody could see what happened. You know, and they watched him stick his face and head in there and flush the toilet, and then he came back and Bob Orton Sr. sitting there. And Slater, he makes no bones about it. You know, he looks right straight at Orton Sr. and he says, do you want some of it? And Sr. goes, just hangs his head. He doesn't say anything at all. No comment. Puts his head down like, obviously, no, I'm okay. You know, I'm fine with that. You know, he'll be all right. And so he did that same routine to Sting. And my brother told me about it. Rob was there for that one. And Sting and Slater got into it at WCW. And Sting's pretty big star. Slater's not such a big star as Sting, obviously, at that point. But actually,
Ron, it was the other way around. It was early on in Sting's career, Sting wasn't yet a star, and Slater had just been the booker. And he was a big star at the top of the card.
Oh, cool. Well, for whatever reason, you know, there was another situation and where there were words exchanged, and bang, Slater got him with that big right hand, and he took his, drug him in and did the old swirl routine in the toilet again. And, you know, I mean, it was, he was really a really tough guy, and it didn't take long. Wrestlers talk pretty heavily about things, and they see those types of things happen, and they pass, that word goes around quickly that, you know, that you got to watch this guy, and you better be very careful about him. So I got one more story, and this is about his wild side, and he came to wrestle for me in 1978 in Knoxville, and I hadn't seen him in several years. He was doing some Japan stuff. He was in and out of the country. He was doing very well. He was driving a Porsche Carrera, a brand new Porsche Carrera. And we went to town in Hazard, Kentucky, to wrestle in Hazard, Kentucky, out of Knoxville. It's in the east side of Tennessee and the east side of Kentucky. And there's a lot of mountains up in there. And a lot of curves, and all of, obviously the roads run around the edge of the mountains, and you know, sometimes there are no fences up there, no barriers to keep you. You drive real crazy, and you go off the mountain. You take that 3,000 or 4,000 foot drop, and obviously you know what the results are. And we're coming back from wrestling in Hazard, and I go to sleep, and he's driving, and I wake up. And I'm awakened by the sound of tires screeching, and it's going eat, eat, eat. And then I realized that the car is going up and down too, so that the wheels are leaving the road. You know, he's driving, and I look at the speedometer, and he's doing 110, and we're in the middle of one of these curves, and no barrier out there, barricade on the outside of the road, and we're just eat, 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 and I say, Dick, I start screaming at him, whoa, slow down, you know, oh, he laughs, you know, it's like a big joke, but, you know, he was like a crazy guy, crazy about partying, he really enjoyed life, and, he was a wonderful guy to be around. During that 78-79 period, when the Knoxville Wrestling War starts, Dick is there during that war with me. And, you know, I felt very comfortable. I had somebody that watched my back for darn sure there. And everybody on the other side in the war, pretty tough dudes there. Nobody wanted to give Dick any problem of any kind. So I really had great and fond thoughts of Dick. He was a great guy, always and a super dude in the ring, one of the best of all time, and I sure hate to see him go. My brother saw him in the hospital, actually, probably about 5 years ago, and my mom had a stent put in, and Rob was leaving the hospital, and he hears somebody go, hey, and he looks around, And it's Dick. It's Slater. He's in a wheelchair. And Rob goes, Dick, what are you doing, man? What are you in a chair for? Well, he really hurt his back badly, and he never really recovered from that back injury. And, I just want to wish the fond farewell, and God bless him. He was a great guy to me, and I'm happy to be able to acknowledge him in some fashion here at the beginning of our program today.
He did stick by you in 79 when everyone else in Knoxville in that leadership position in the locker room didn't. He was the one guy that did. So it says a lot about your friendship with him. And those were some really good stories there. And I got to ask, when you flush the toilet and the guy's head is in there, is that an act of kindness? So that they don't drown? Like, what's the theory behind the flush?
I call it the swirl because, you know, the toilet, it goes there, it swirls around, you know, and I don't know. I'd never seen anybody do that before. It was kind of like Dick's little M.O. And I've heard stories. He did it to several other guys. He liked to get them with that big right. And then he would always, if there's a toilet handy, he liked to. I guess that's the utter humiliation of it all, you know, to get your face after you knock cold stuffed down into a dirty toilet and water flushed. But, you know, that's kind of like Slater. It's kind of what he was all about. Let's go on to where we are. You know, let's go back to, I've left Australia. So on March the 1st of 1973, my family and I catch our first flight, and we take off out of Sydney, and we're going to lose 2 days on the way home. We're going to lose 1 day when we cross over the international date line going the wrong way. We're going to also change planes. We're going to have some layovers. It's going to take 30 hours basically to get back. We lose a day and we lose another 30 hours in the trip itself. So we're going to arrive back in West Palm Beach on my birthday, which is March the 3rd. And I'm exhausted and battered and bruised because during my time there in Australia, I didn't realize how much I wrestled until I went back and looked at it. But I wrestled 65 times in 51 days. I wrestled televisions, all their televisions. I wrestled every night. I had one night off while I was there. And that is just a grueling schedule. But it made me
Hold
a much
on.
Better
Say that again, Ron. 65 times in 51 days.
Yeah. There would be days. Now, and the way that can happen is there was a TV in Brisbane, and they did three TVs in one day. And I would wrestle sometimes on all three of those TVs. So, and then you would wrestle that night in a spot show somewhere. So I'd wrestle sometimes four times on Thursday. So, as I said, when I went in there and I told the old boy that in the office there with Barnett that I wanted to work every night, and he said he thought I was crazy. You know, they took me at my word and they ran the hell out of me and they booked me big time and they had me shooting with guys and all those things. But I worked 65 times in 51 days. That's just an amazing number. And it bruised me and battered me, and I was unhealthy and I needed rest, but it made me a much better wrestler when I came home. That 65 days kind of, that 51 days and all that wrestling in that time frame made me a lot better wrestler. And so I began to feel that it was my time to shine kind of when I started coming home. I could tell that I'm kind of getting it, you know, and sometimes it takes a long time for a guy to get it. I knew I needed to rest, that's for sure, when I got off the plane on March the 3rd in 73. But I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to get much of rest, I can tell you that. So 2 days later, I'm in the ring on March the 5th, and I'm in a six-man tag match. It's right there, thank goodness. It's right there at home in West Palm. And I'm going to be in the ring with my brother and Big Bad John. And we're going to wrestle against Dick Slater, Gorgeous George Jr., and Chris Markoff. And I need to tell this story. I'd bought the bag, this beautiful wrestling bag, made out of kangaroo and crocodile, and had those brand new wrestling boots made out of kangaroo that were white. They had that inlaid baby blue the pieces of colored leather on the sides of them. They were gorgeous. And when I came into the dressing room and set my bag down, everybody in the dressing room went nuts. They all had to come and rub it. And what is this, man? You know, what's that? What is that? What is that? Alligator? No, it's crocodile, right? You know, they were really into it. And then when I unzipped the bag and I took out those kangaroo boots, there was like a, here they came again. They were like, wow, Ron, where'd you get those, man? They're the most beautiful boots I've ever seen. So, you know, I'm a better wrestler, and I'm coming home. I'm beginning to shine in a lot more ways than just in the ring. I've got these beautiful boots, and I make these trips everywhere I took that bag on airplanes. It didn't make any difference where I went. Everybody was just astounded by it. They were like, wow, I've never seen a bag that beautiful. So we're in a six-man tag. We win the match that night, and I win the match, actually, with a drop kick. You know, and when I get back into the dressing room, everybody's like, wow, man, you were up there higher than, I think I drop kicked Gorgeous George Jr. And they said, you had to drop kick him downward. You were higher than his head, Ron. You had to kick downward in his face with both feet. So they were really into it. And I'd come home in a really good manner. You know, I got kind of like a hero's welcome in the dressing room because I'd been gone for more than 2 months. And Louis Tillette is the booker. Now, he's the new booker in Florida at this time when I come home. And just give fans, maybe they don't know who Louis Tillette is, but Louis Tillette was a 5'9", about 5'9", and a French-Canadian from Montreal area. And he was trained by Mad Dog Vachon. He is a darn good worker and an even better talker. And he was, and as a booker, he's a smart booker. He is smart enough as a booker to stay behind the scenes, not wrestle every night, not push himself. And that way he's going to build a stronger relationship with the talent that's in there. They're going to like him. It's difficult to be a booker if you're going to be one of the boys, and especially if you're going to be a top guy and push yourself, because they guys think, well, heck, you know, he's the booker, and it's not fair. You know, it's hard to keep a good relationship with your boys if you're on top and you're doing the booking too. But Louis's pretty sharp, and he doesn't push himself, and he doesn't even wrestle every night, but he comes to every town and he handles finishes and he handles business. But he's smart about that, and he always maintains a great relationship. He's going to work for me in Knoxville in the late 70s. And then he's going to work for me again in Pensacola in Southeastern when I start that company. He's going to bring Hulk Hogan to my business. That's where Hulk Hogan gets his start, as Louis gets him out of Tampa. So he bounces back and forth. Starting in 1962, he makes his first appearance in Florida. He's going to go to Georgia in 1968. He's going to do a stint in Texas in the early 1970, and he's going to come back in 1973 about this same time frame when I'm coming out of Australia, and he's going to be booking there. Now, Rob and I know him. We have a relationship with him because in the late 60s, he's in Georgia, and he's working with Dad, and we're beginning to be able to go into the dressing room, and he's a really nice, likable guy, and we kind of create a little relationship with him. So we're sitting in a good spot. He's booking here, and we're both in there, and we're both becoming better workers in the ring. And so I tell him about, you know, Louis, I've worked a whole bunch in Australia, and I'm really beat up. And is there any way I could get a little time off just to get my body healed back up to where I can go full speed? And so he says, okay. You know, he gets his book out right there, and he looks, and he goes, look, Ron, he goes, I'm going to give you this day, this day, this day, this day, this day. He gives me 16 days off and the rest of the month of March, which that's really unusual to get that type of break. But he does it because he knows that he's going to push me. He knows that in April, and he does, he makes up for the 16 days he gives me off in March because I'm going to work every day in April. I'm not going to get a day off in April. And then he's going to start using me really, really well. And one match in particular that sticks out in my mind is 13 days after I come back out of Australia. I have a really memorable evening, and I work in Seminole, Florida, which is like it's only 30 miles from Tampa, from downtown Tampa. And Tampa is usually a Tuesday night town. This is a Thursday night little spot show. And I'm working partners with Eddie Graham. It's me and Eddie versus the Mighty Yankees. And after the match, Eddie spent a lot of time with me. I grew up around Eddie, but I never felt Eddie had respect for me, but that night he invites me. He says, I want you to go to dinner with me tonight. So we go and eat dinner, just Eddie and I. And, you know, we have one of the greatest nights I ever had with Eddie. We talk about everything. He discusses with me the aborted world title switch that was going to take place with Junior and Jack Briscoe March the 2nd, supposed to be in Houston. And he talks about, you know, you and I have talked a little bit about that, Brian. He talks about, you know, how Senior got upset because he wanted Junior to remain the champion. And he really lays all that information on me. And, you know, I've felt really privileged because Eddie is, this point, is beginning to be a big guy in the NWA. And when he lays all this on me, I'm really impressed that, you know, that he would tell me that type of thing. And he discusses the derogatory, what happened between his friendship with Senior and over this event. You know, where Jack is going to take the title and Junior then has this accident on the ranch out there in Texas, supposedly. All that ties in with Australia, where we've just come from. The big tournament doesn't take place over there because of this match that doesn't happen on March the 2nd. And that's just a few days. We're just a few days away from that March the 2nd day. So we talk about that. He compliments me on how I've improved as a worker, and he even talks to me a little bit about, you know, how far he thinks I can go in the sport, you know. And he really, you know, he makes me feel really good in this conversation that night. And he talks about his close relationship with my dad, which they did have a really, really close relationship. And Dad's still in Australia. And I come away from that night for the first time since ever being around Eddie. I feel like he's as much a father figure to me as a friend at this point. He just really, really puts me over, as we say in the business. And it's really been a great experience for me.
Couple questions for you, Ron. Obviously, you and Eddie worked this show in Seminole, then you have this conversation. But during this period of time, March of 73, Eddie is spending a lot of time in Georgia, obviously. He received stock in Georgia after everything went down, and that stock would later go to various wrestlers. But he's working regular shows in Macon. He's working in Columbus. He's working in Atlanta. So he's bouncing back and forth. What was it like for you coming back from Australia into Florida? How much was Eddie around, and was there a noticeable difference when he wasn't?
Well, it was always a noticeable difference when Eddie wasn't there. When Eddie was there, you could watch the matches and see sometimes a difference in the matches. Guys would put out more when Eddie's there. He's the man. He's the owner of the company, and he is Florida Wrestling. And if you want to go places, you better be doing your best when Eddie's watching. And yeah, and you're right about it. I mean, the war's going on. It's just in its infancy. It's just getting cranked up and rolling. But they need this really good talent up there to compete with what Ann has got, because she has the whole crew there that has been over on television. And they're at a distinct disadvantage. Lester and Eddie have a great relationship because Lester spent a lot of time in Florida as well. So Eddie makes a commitment along with the rest of the NWA to really help them. And in order to do that, he's going to work those towns. He's going to spend a lot of time in Georgia in 73. And that particular night, kind of a fluke. I don't know how that got set up or why that happened, that he happens to be my partner. But it was really a good thing for me. And it just gave me a real incentive to do better, to just keep cranking it and become a better wrestler.
You had become a really good wrestler. I mean, we'll talk later on in the program about it, but some footage has recently emerged of you around this period of time, and you're really good. And I'm wondering, when you look back now and you see that Jack Briscoe was due to win the world title in Houston, Dory Funk Jr. has this accident, the Jack Briscoe, Eddie Graham side is suspicious of the accident, the Funks insist it's a genuine thing, Paul Bosch is upset, because now Houston doesn't get its title change.
Right.
And then they get the belt onto Harley Race when Dory Funk can wrestle again, and then Harley, in Houston, Bosch gets his title change, drops it to Jack Briscoe. So during this period of time, Jack's not the champion, but everyone knows Jack's going to be the champion. And that tour of Australia Jack had was because Jack was going to go over there as the NWA champion. And obviously things had to be phrased a little different. Now it was Dory Funk is hurt, so the number one challenger will be coming over, which worked pretty convenient. But Jack Briscoe's not going to be around as much in Florida. You end up working in St. Louis not too long after this. Do you think that Eddie was maybe trying to, you know, if you hadn't bought Southeastern, do you think you would have had a bigger role? Do you think they were trying to set you up for being one of those key guys in Florida?
Yeah, I do. And you know, I sometimes have regrets in the way making the decision to become a promoter and to give up that I was really banging into some big markets. I'm going to wrestle in New York City and in 73 and in Philadelphia for Vince Sr. And I'm going to make a lot of shots in St. Louis. There was a big push happening in my direction, and I was just trying to get better and bigger. I'm a little thin in this time frame. I haven't filled out yet because I guess my family has that about them. They don't fill out until they get to be in their late 20s, early 30s. So, I felt like that, you know, if I had not decided to go to Knoxville and start my own company, that I would have had a chance to maybe to be world champion. It could have potentially happened. I had the backing. Obviously, Eddie would have been there for me as far as pushing for me, and Dad was pretty well involved in a lot of stuff. Jim Barnett was a big fan and a great guy and pushed me as well. And you know, I would have maybe had a whole different life for myself had I done it. Had I not decided that I wanted to be a wrestler and a promoter and do it all like my dad had done and my granddad. I think that's probably why I made that decision, is because of the two forerunners in my family that had done the same thing and had great success being wrestlers and promoters.
And you wouldn't have gotten into a tractor accident right before you were going to drop the title. We could say that. One more question for you, Ron. You said all the boys went crazy over your bag that you came home with. What was the reaction to your boots? You spent a lot of time talking about these boots you had made. What was the reaction in the locker room to those?
Everybody says, everybody lined up. And you know, when I left Australia, I told the guy that made the boots for me, and he handmade them, and he measured my calves and my ankles and my feet around. The boots were just handmade for me. Best boots I ever owned. And I got several pairs of them because they were so nice. But the guys went so nuts that they all came to me, and I anticipated this. I asked the guy in Australia, I said, give me a handful of cards because I think you're going to get business. And guys were coming to me, and they go, where in the heck did you get those boots made? You know, and then they would pick them up, and they're not leather, so they're not that thick and that pliable. You know, like leather is kind of firm, and that kangaroo is kind of a soft. But it would last just as long as leather. So I passed out the cards. I told the guy I would. And, you know, then it wasn't too long before I started seeing my boots. Guys were doing the same inlays that I got done on these boots. They would color them. You know, they'd try to get the white ones. And a lot of those boots were coming out of Australia.
We will return to Florida in just one moment. But first, a word about Super Studcast number 10, as well as the brand new rest of the story on the Atlanta Wrestling War.
Fans are going crazy for the outrageous Jim Cornette Super Studcast number 10 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. It's only $2.99. Hear for yourself the two old school icons go head to head, exchanging hilarious stories as only they can. Then get the recently released rest of the story for Super Studcast number 10 free. It's a first ever special edition show that follows up the three record Atlanta Wrestling War Studcast. The Stud, confirmed by the great Brian Last Research, challenges and changes the 46-year-old wrestling history about his family and who really started the Atlanta War. It's fascinating and all there in this classic one-hour-plus rest of the story at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. It's one thing for a wrestling podcast to talk history, but only the Stud can actually change history.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 10 with Jim Cornette, as well as the brand new rest of the story on the Atlanta Wrestling War, where we talk about the timeline of events, as well as recently discovered, recently uncovered documents that fill in more detail about the Atlanta Wrestling War. You can get those shows at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. More information about that later in the show. But Ron, let's return to Florida. Let's return to March of 1973.
Yeah, well, there was a most unusual match on the 30th of March in 1973. I'm in a lights out match, and I've been in lights out matches, a couple of them. I'm young, and I didn't have an opportunity to do many of them. But right away, I'm starting to get into these better matches. And this is a lights out match, but it's a lights out tag team match. I don't think it may be the only lights out tag match I ever had in Florida. And Louis Tillette is my partner, and we're wrestling against Buddy Colt and Chris Markoff, two great talents. And I noticed that in the end of the match and during the course of the match that there's three of us bleeding in the ring at the same time. Well, it's a lights out match, and you can expect that there should be some of that. But the fact that there's three of us in there, I rode home after that, drove home after the match that night, and I was thinking about how much blood there was in that match. And I got to thinking, are we seeing a different style of booking than the one of solid wrestling and little blood that's always been the way in the Florida, and Florida since I came there? You know, I see Louis here. It's Dad would say he's hot-shotting it. You know, that was his term for it. He didn't like to have too much blood, and he didn't like to have that type of thing. But there we are in a lights out tag match. I've not been there long enough to really that for that to make sense for me to be popped into that position. And I'm a little leery, and I'm a little hesitant for the future of Florida if that's where we're going. And, because of Eddie. It's because of Eddie for all those years when I'm young and getting started there and spending that time in the snake pit. It's all shooting, man. It's all wrestling. It's not blood. It's wrestling. And, you know, my thoughts are, is Louis going to change this from being wrestling territory to a blood territory? And, you know, sometimes that makes territories explode. You know, a lot of violent matches and a lot of that will get you big houses. But the question is, what does it do to the business long term, to people's, to the viability and to people believing in it? You've got to give them a lot of wrestling. And if you can build your business around a lot of wrestling and do great business and big crowds and very little blood, you're going to have a solid business for as long as you run it that way. And I was somewhat concerned with what maybe where Louis's ideas are and where he's headed with this.
On this day, on this specific day, March 30th, 1973, to my earlier point, Eddie Graham's in Atlanta. He's wrestling in Atlanta that night. So is that part of the reason why maybe Florida started taking that turn in direction, because Eddie wasn't there to supervise every little thing?
That's a very good point, Brian. I mean, yeah. I mean, Eddie's wrestling oriented. He's shooting oriented. He wants to build everything around that wrestling. And my dad's just as much in the same direction as Eddie, maybe even more so. And now Louie's there and Eddie's gone, and Louie knows that Eddie's not going to be there. Louie's in a position where he's taken the book and he has to be successful. And in order to be successful, he says, well, you know, Eddie's not here and he's not going to see it, and I can hotshot it a little bit. Let me do some things that's not been done, and business will climb even more. It'll solidify his position as a booker, and he'll benefit from it all the way around. So, yeah, there's a potential that that's exactly what happened. So on April the 3rd, you know, just a few days after that match in 73, I'm going to get my first title shot since returning from Australia. I'm going to get a title shot with Paul Jones for the Southern Heavyweight Championship in Tampa. You know, when I first came to Florida, I never got to wrestle in Tampa very much. I was a young guy, and I was a Fort Myers guy, and I was always relegated to Fort Myers, and I occasionally got a shot in Tampa, but I'd be first or second match. I'm looking at a main event here with Paul Jones. Paul Jones is a tremendous worker. Gosh, back in that day, he was really, really good. And for me as a young guy, 3 years in, this is an opportunity, man, to work with some of the very best guys on the planet. And so I win that match that night by disqualification. And you can't win the title on disqualification. So a week later, they bring the match back on April 10th, 1973. I wrestle against Paul Jones again in a really unusual match. There's not many of those that happen anymore, but we wrestle a 2 out of 3 fall tag match for the championship. And, you know, it's an experience to wrestle a 2 out of 3 fall match. You're not used to them. Almost everything now is one fall matches and a lot of different talent and more matches rather than less matches and 2 out of 3 fall matches that last longer. Well, this is a 2 out of 3. You're really not in shape for that. You really learn how to work when you're in one of those long matches like that. So in this championship match, I win the first fall in the match, and Paul wins the second. And ultimately, at the end of the match, I win my first title in my career on that night on April 10th, 1973. It's exactly 38 days since I returned from Australia, and I have been a pro for less than 3 years. Pretty insane for that to happen for a guy that young.
In that era, Ron, how common was it for, I was about to say a rookie, it's not a rookie necessarily, but how common was it for a newcomer within the first 3-4 years of their career to get a major territorial championship?
Oh, it was very, very difficult. It just practically never happened. Guys used to tell me all the time, and I talked to guys like Dusty. Dusty was good about that. Dusty had been around a long time. He and Murdoch, and we talked a lot about how long does it take you to find yourself? How long does it take you to really learn what you can do in the ring that gets people, and how to get people, and when to get people, and all of those things. They always hit me with a figure of 5 years. They said, you know, Ron, if you can do it in 5 years, you'll be lucky. It's just really difficult to find to get that ability and to learn everything you need to learn, the psychology of it and everything else. So, you know, 3 years in, it's a pretty remarkable event, to happen. You know, it's pretty much unheard of. To win a big championship like that at 3 years in. I think, and I'm going to be honest with you about this too, Brian, some of this has to do with the fact that Jack's not there. Jack has been the hoss. He has been the big baby face in Florida for years, since I came there in 70. I look up to him, and the fans look up to him. The workers look up to him. Jack's the man, but Jack is going to become the world champion, and Jack is gone. He's not going to be there in Florida all the time anymore, and it appears that they've kind of looked at me and said, you know, this kid may be ready. He may be the guy to try to take Jack's place. And that's part of it, I believe.
Ron, one question I did have. Obviously, you going to Australia was in the middle of you also being a promoter. And you at West Palm Beach. What's the status of West Palm Beach upon your return?
Well, West Palm, when I went to Australia, my brother was working in the territory at this same time frame. And when I went to Australia, Dad worked out a deal with Eddie, and they both agreed on it that they will have Rob take my responsibilities in West Palm. So Rob went and did a lot of the things that I was doing to make West Palm such a good town for them. And it was a good experience for Rob, and he obviously did a pretty decent job. The town would have suffered some, and the town, they had pushed me in West Palm. That's helped me too. That's maybe why I could do this in 3 years when a lot of guys couldn't, is because they knew I lived there. I'm handling the promotion, and they needed a baby face over there, and they pushed me way before I would have been pushed normally, simply because I was helping to promote that town.
Well, I'll tell you, and, you know, it's funny, we're talking about this period of time. Recently, I found, I was looking for some stuff on YouTube, and I ran into some footage of you from this period of time, April 73, against Paul Jones. You know, you just talked about it. And if anyone wants to check it out, you can go to YouTube. Also, I believe we're going to try to get it up on tnstud.com so everyone can check it out there. But, Ron, it's amazing footage of you, and you're really good at this period of time. Like you said, I didn't even think about it when I watched it in the context of you'd only been in the business around 3 years. But it's really, really good stuff.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I haven't had the chance really to see this one yet, I'm really looking forward to it. But I knew I was putting out. I was really working hard back in those days. I knew I was being pushed, and I knew I was getting a heck of an opportunity here. And I'm just, it's just in its infancy, because I'm going to really get pushed bigger when they start sending me off to St. Louis on the weekends and that type of stuff. But thanks, man, for turning us on to this, to the video. And I will put it on my website, put it on tnstud.com. You're becoming more than just a co-host here with me, Brian. You're getting me pushed really good, man. So I appreciate it a lot. So, I'm going to make title defenses. Now I got the title, I'm a grinder. I'm a young guy that just can't do enough. And so I tell Louie, I said, Louie, I want to defend. I want to defend every night as much as possible. So I make my first title defense 2 days later. 2 days after I win it, I'm defending it in Orlando. I get a really warm welcome from Milo and Dick Steinborn. Milo runs that town, been there. It's his town, basically, is the way most wrestlers see it. And Dick Steinborn is a phenomenal talent in himself and a great guy. And both those guys give me a great welcome when I come back. And I haven't worked in Orlando very much because I'm in another Monday night town. My town runs same night as Orlando does. I've been there for 3 years or 2 years now in West Palm. I've become a big star, but I've not worked in Orlando because they keep me in West Palm so that they can run two major cities on the same night. They have to divide that talent pretty equally, and they do a real good job of it in making both those towns draw. In fact, that's their biggest night in Florida. Is their Monday, which is a strange night to be their best night, but because they've got those two major towns and they're both doing well. We go in the ring that night, And it's hot, you know, it's really hot in Florida. It's in that time of year occasionally. And we have, I go to the ring, and I've been working on TV for a couple of years, two or three years there. And those tapes go into Orlando. So because I haven't been there doesn't mean I'm not getting over. And I didn't realize how over I was in Orlando until they rang the bell and I went to the ring that night. And my walk to the ring was like, wow, geez, man, these people like me. And when they made the introduction and introduced me, it was like, I got goosebumps, which I do occasionally, and that usually means that somebody's going to get a wraparound or something, you know. I mean, something's got to happen here. Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm getting fired up, and we're just getting the introduction. So we have a great match that night. I remember some of it, and we probably worked 40 minutes or so, you know. We go close to an hour. And we tear the darn house down, me and Paul Jones again. And there's no air conditioning in a lot of these Florida buildings. There's no air conditioning in the Armory in Tampa. There's no air conditioning in the Sportatorium or the Sports Arena in Orlando. So it's unbearable. Some people pass out in there from the heat, and they're not in the ring. So when you get in the ring and you're in one of those hot buildings, you got no air conditioning and people are smoking, it's a stress. It's a stress on your body and surely a stress on your lungs. Well, I win that night. The next night, I go to Tampa, and I'm now in this match. I'm in a Tampa match against the Florida heavyweight champion. I'm the Southern heavyweight champion. Buddy Colt is the Florida heavyweight champion. And this match, I put up my title against his title. And the winner of this match is going to be both Southern and Florida heavyweight champion. The temperature, I remember that night when we got there, I guess it's a hot spell for that time of year, was 89 degrees outside the building at bell time. And inside, it's well over 100 degrees. You got all those bodies in there, and there are very few windows. The windows in that old armory there in Tampa were set up real high, and you didn't get any breeze. It was really, really steaming in that building every time you went in there and worked. So we're working in 100 degree plus temperature. Fans are smoking. Back in the day, they were smoking too. I mean, you could come out of the dressing room and you could hardly see the ring sometimes for the smoke in the air. So, you know, you got all that to deal with. And then you take that and add to the fact that Colt is a great worker. He's a veteran. He's been around. He's done it, man. He's great movement in the ring. He's up and down. He's in phenomenal shape, and he always pushes you. He's always pushing. So during this match, we have a long match, as I remember, and I think he ends up bleeding in this match. And at the end of this match, I kind of go crazy, basically. You know, that's what they want me to do, and I give them a pretty darn good crazy, as I remember it, crazy man for them. And there's no winner. I mean, he leaves the ring, and he drags me with him. I'm going to the dressing room with him, you know. So there's no winner, but, you know, I realize that during this match that I'm starting to see now what the grind and the toll it takes to be a champion. If you're going to wrestle in these big arenas packed with people and these boiling hot temperatures and all the things that are negative to being able to handle it, and then you're going to do it every night. It's really it just pushes you to the absolute limit. I'm going to defend the Southern Heavyweight Championship. I'm going to defend it a record number of times. I'll defend it. I told Louis, I want to defend it. Let's book me with big guys and let's do it often. And he took me at my word. So after I win the title, the next 12 nights straight, I defend the Southern Heavyweight Championship every night, 12 nights in a row. Three times against Dale Lewis, big star, big guy. To deal with in the ring, you've got to be, he's tough. He's tough. He wears you out. He does a lot of wrestling, and he'll get you down on the mat, and he rides you a lot. And it takes your wind away. It's difficult to wrestle Dale Lewis. So I wrestled three times him for the championship. I wrestled three times with Buddy Colt. And I wrestled Paul Jones six times during that 12-night period. And a lot of these matches, we're not doing this 15. We're not doing the WWE style of a 4-minute, 5-minute, 6-minute deal. We're doing 30 to 45, 50 minutes per night, every night. And that kind of stuff just takes a bruising toll on your body. It's just really, really difficult to be able to handle that kind of grind night after night. But gosh, man, it's making me a darn good worker. It's really making me, and people are taking notice, not just the guys in the dressing room, but Sam Muchnick up there in St. Louis is—he's taking notice, and I'm being talked about, and I guess I'm on a real rocket shot here toward the top. In 73, I'm going to go from being a nobody in January to being somebody pretty darn big by December of 73.
Ron, the person that uploaded the footage of you against Paul Jones also uploaded the footage of you against Buddy Colt, the match that you were actually just talking about, and has Gordon Solie and Johnny Valentine, of all people, on commentary. And I'm going to suggest you put this on the website also, tnstud.com, but anyone could check it out. You could just do a Google search. You could say Ron Fuller, Buddy Colt, or Ron Fuller, Paul Jones, and see it. Really, really cool footage. Ron, I did want to ask you, you are now the Southern Heavyweight Champion. What is the life like as a champion in terms of, do you carry the belt around with you everywhere you go? When you go home with the belt for the first time, what's that like? What's it like being a champion?
I guess having grown up in wrestling, I probably didn't take it the way some guys would. I remember stories about guys winning their first championship and sleeping with the belt. And, you know, I don't know if they meant it just laid it in the bed and rolled over on it, or whether they actually strapped it on and slept with it. You know, I never really asked anybody what, you know, and I didn't go that far, you know, but I was working hard, and I really, really appreciated that I was being pushed. But you know, it's always an honor. It's like being it's a reward being a champion, and winning a championship is kind of a reward, and it tells you that you are being noticed and that you're being appreciated. And Florida's a tough territory to work because of the heat. And you know, it gets worse as the summer goes on. You know, when summertime 73, I'm still going to be doing it with these same guys. And you just mentioned one of them is going to be in the ring with me. And gosh, you talking about, having your hands full and spending all night in a 1-hour match is Johnny Valentine. Gosh almighty. You know, I haven't had a chance to see this match either, and I'm really looking forward to it. But the fact that, you know, you've got Gordon Solie and Johnny Valentine commentating over this match, and what they were doing back in those days, Brian, no one else in the country was doing. It was one of the reasons that Florida's business was so fantastic, is they were shooting these house matches, and then they would go back and into the studio, and they would cut those matches down, but they would just pick up the action parts of it. They'd take a 1-hour match and they'd chop it down into 7 minutes. And when you do that, you gotta, that's a phenomenal piece of footage there. And when you've got these type of guys, you got Gordon Solie and Johnny Valentine talking over my match, that's gotta be fantastic. I haven't heard it, but I can just imagine that, you know. And I remember this match, and it's a pretty grueling match, and I really I really go after Colt in this match. And I'm curious to see just how they did talk about this, because, you know, I'm young, I'm thin, I'm not near what I'm going to be as a worker, but I'm sure getting there at this point. And I'm looking forward to seeing those videos myself. And I'm definitely going to put them on the website on TN Stud. And there's a lot of videos on there. There's me and Stomper, and there's a lot of great videos on my website. And these two are, geez, I'm going to stick them up top because, you know, I'll be the first one to see them.
Well, Ron, in general, are you someone who enjoys watching old footage of yourself, or do you critique it and have a tough time watching it? I mean, in general, do you like watching footage of yourself?
I've never, be honest with you, Brian, I've never seen anything that far back. This will be some of the oldest footage I've seen with me. And like I say, I'm only 3 years in. So, you're awfully, oftentimes very critical of yourself when you watch yourself back and you think about what you could have done, what you should have done, you know. But I'm really curious about these. I haven't seen anything where I'm that far back. Some of the stuff that's on the video in my video library on tnstud.com, it's me and Stomper and me and Jack Briscoe. I've got a match with Jack Briscoe on there, and Bob Armstrong. Matches from anywhere from 78 on into the 80s. But going back to 73, that's really catching me at a young time, and I'm really looking forward to seeing just how I handle it.
Well, you'll have to let us know next week on the show what you did think of it, going back and watching this for the first time. But until then, as we wrap things up, we want to remind you that you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook, the page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter, at Great Brian Last. You can listen to me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast. We talked a little bit earlier about tnstud.com. It is the place to go for both the Studcast and the Super Studcast, the rest of the story, Tennessee Stud souvenirs, the video library, and so much more, tnstud.com. And on the topic of the Super Studcast, don't miss the red-hot two-hour Jim Cornette Super Studcast number 10, available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast only. $2.99, and you can now get the 1 hour rest of the story. This one will be a very special edition, revealing recent discoveries and discussing the timeline regarding the Atlanta Wrestling War. So stay tuned for that. The rest of the story, the Atlanta Wrestling War, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, next week, we got the ball rolling here. Things are really starting to change for me. I'm on my way to making a record, all-time record number of Southern title defenses in a short period of time. Like I said, I've already gotten 12 nights in a row after winning it. And I'm shooting for some kind of record, putting that belt up. And I'm going to get my first world title shot with the new champion, Harley Race. He's just won it out there. He's lost it, actually, to, well, he's won it, and he's not lost it to Jack at this point. And he's coming to Florida, and they're going to give me that shot with Harley. And that's a big feather in my cap. And I'm going to make my first appearance in probably the most historic wrestling city in the world, St. Louis. Muchnick is taking a liking to me. He's heard some good things about me, and I'm going to start going to St. Louis just like Jack Briscoe did before me. That's where Jack made his name. That's where he got his fame, and that's how I think he became world champion, and it kind of looks like I may be walking in Jack's footsteps.
Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.